Melody Westerdahl versus Name Intelligence et al. I believe I have 10 minutes. I don't remember if it was 10 or 15.
You have 10 minutes, yes.
I'll reserve 3 for rebuttal.
You said 3, correct?
Hey, pardon?
You said 3?
3.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Stern. I'm the attorney for Perrin Melody Westerdahl. This is the first case since the receivership statute was substantially amended 10 years ago to come before the court. So the court is, to some degree, writing on a clean slate. On the other hand, receiverships have been around since the equity receiverships of the 1840s when they were used for railroads, and there is a long history of equity jurisprudence and how receiverships are supposed to function. In this case, Mr. and Mrs. Westerdahl were involved in a number of transactions with their son, Jay Westerdahl. Because everyone is named Westerdahl, I will refer to them as the elder Westerdahls and Jay, with no due respect, but that's the only way to separate them, and that's what we did in the brief. The elder Westerdahls and Jay got into a business relationship with a gentleman by the name of
Burrow. We're pretty familiar with the facts. I mean, move right on to the legal issues.
The legal issue is, again, one of first impression.
Let me ask you a couple questions. If you were to prevail with the 25% interest claim be subject to a jury trial?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Are claim disputes and receiverships generally have the prospect of being tried to a jury as opposed to the judge?
Generally speaking, no, Your Honor. Generally speaking, equity pervades receiverships and...
So we would be construing the statute if we were to accept your argument.
Correct.
In a way that would deprive what our state Supreme Court has found to be a pretty substantial constitutional right.
I don't know, because I think, Your Honor, if a jury trial was requested, it could certainly be ordered. There's a procedure for setting up when I have filed.
Well, that's my question. Is that available under the receivership statute?
I believe it is. There are no cases that say it isn't. And if the court were to direct that it be tried to a jury, I can't conceive of why it couldn't happen. I know that in the past, when I have brought actions for violation of the stay, or if the receiver brings a fraudulent conveyance action, what normally happens is that another lawsuit gets filed in the Superior Court. It then gets generally assigned to the same judge, but it's a separate proceeding with a separate cause number, and it proceeds like a trial.
Do that, why wouldn't that frustrate the concept of judicial economy? Because that separate lawsuit's available after the dismissal of the receiver.
Didn't say it was a perfect system, Your Honor.
Well, we're looking to make it as simple as possible, and having two lawsuits doesn't seem to be as simple as one.
Well, Your Honor, what we have here is either one equity proceeding where we can estimate the claim and say, this is it, you get paid, or two lawsuits where we terminate the receivership, even though the Westerdahls have filed claims. They've got their process in line of what they're doing, and the court says, well, go start a new lawsuit over, at least here.
What I'm trying to explore is what would be different for your clients if they're forced to pursue a separate lawsuit as opposed to pursuing it in the receivership. I thought maybe the jury trial was an issue. You've disabused me of that notion. Discovery would seem to be equally available. So what's the disadvantage to your client to just pursuing a separate lawsuit?
There are two, Your Honor. The Westerdahls are elderly. They're in their 80s. If we were to file a case in King County, we could be there for the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay, in asbestos cases, King County remedied that with expedited discovery and trial dates. That would, and I've seen it done for elderly clients in PI cases. That would accommodate that concern. What's your other one?
Jay is young. He's got control of the assets. He's making money, and the Westerdahls are living on Social Security and retirement, and they are, there's no way they're going to be able to fund litigation when there's already a, they've already filed a claim in the receivership and the...
Okay, let me go back then. I thought this was going to be similar litigation to a separate lawsuit, so how would the economic cost be different?
The economic costs, Your Honor, are to go, I've tried cases in Superior Court, and we're talking about a two or three or four or five day trial. If you have a claims estimation procedure, you estimate the claim. That takes a half a day. And the court says, this is what the claim's estimated to be. We're going to pay it on that basis. That's provided for in the statute.
Does that process apply when the liability part of the claim is disputed?
I believe it does, Your Honor. Again, there's no case law on it.
So for the claims estimation process to be as abbreviated as you hope, that would pretty much presuppose no witness testimony, just pretty much everything on declarations, and the receiver would make a recommendation, and then the judge would just make it a decision, right?
Pretty much. I've seen that in estimation of medical claims that you put on two or three lawyers who try personal injury cases and have them testify as to what it's worth. That's a lot different than putting on five doctors and 10 physical therapists and everyone else. It's a very streamlined process. So yes, there would have to be some testimony to make a record, but it's not. You have to prove up your case, and you have to I mean, what we are speaking in this case is mostly written records and written documents, so it's not going to be a long set of testimony to, I mean, there are three witnesses or four witnesses, unless you get into to Jay's interference with the trustees.
Thank you.
Yep, 3 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court. Howard Goodfriend representing Jay Westerdahl and the Westerdahl Corp. LLC, as well as Name Intelligence, Inc. The issue really is one of the standard of review of the order terminating the receivership. It's very clearly an abuse of discretion standard. That's based on the plain language of the statute. It's based on the policy of the statute. It's also based on the equitable nature of receivership. So the issue really is, was the decision by Judge Kessler to terminate this receivership at a cost of $6,000 per month plus $550 per hour for counsel, was that outside the range of reasonable choices, where it was undisputed that the receivership had fulfilled all of the duties for which the receivership was established under 025. It had been commenced to satisfy a $1.4 million judgment for breach of a settlement agreement, and the order appointing the receiver stated that it shall terminate only upon payment in full of all amounts due receiver and satisfaction in full of all amounts due under the judgment for which the receivership was appointed to enforce. The receiver was paid. The judgment was satisfied in full in December of 2014. Per and Melody Westerdahl were paid in full, $395,000, on their subrogation claim that they had asserted against Jay for advancing partial satisfaction of this Barrow judgment, and the only thing remaining was an unliquidated, disputed, contested claim by the Westerdahls for a 25% interest in the domain name holiday.com. that was not based on a writing, but purely a verbal claim. And as the receiver acknowledged before the court, before Judge Kessler, as the Westerdahls, the elder Westerdahls, acknowledged at the hearing on March 20th before Judge Kessler, that claim could only be resolved after discovery and after trial.
Do you agree with appellant's position based in response to Judge Leach's question that there could have been some other procedure set up here? I'll make up some deadlines that they would say, okay, you're going to have 6 months to do this. Here's the discovery schedule. Here is that. I'm going to allow a day for testimony. I'll come back and we'll resolve it. And then it really wouldn't be a claims estimation, it seems to me. But
well,
would the statute allow that?
The statute would not allow claim estimation when it's a contested claim.
Right,
so let's start with that. Let's get set that aside.
Okay.
So the issue is, did the court supervising the receiver have the authority to set up a claims resolution process? Yes, I think it did. Would there be a right to a jury trial? Probably.
We don't need to decide that if we decide this choice was a reasonable one.
Absolutely. You don't need to go through any of that. Because what Judge Kessler said, I can do those things, but you will be no worse off than if I dismiss the receiver, terminate the receivership, save this ongoing expense of $6,000 a month with counsel there from Foster Pepper at $550 an hour, so that this claim that had nothing to do with the initiation of the receivership, that would not be a grounds for starting a receivership in the first instance, and that was fully contested and required resolution in some process, which everybody conceded involved discovery and some time and testimony, why have the receivership? That's what Judge Kessler held. And there,
so
you know,
it's as simple as two proceedings versus one.
Yes, it's complicated by the fact that the receivership is sucking money from.
All right, but the second, the ancillary, probably bad choice of words, the merits litigation is going to be the same whether it's under the rubric of the receivership or a separate lawsuit.
That's correct. Yeah, I think that's right.
So we're just trimming away one.
One layer of one extraneous layer of expense and complication to allow a prompt resolution on the merits. Now, the statute 290(5) is clearly phrased in discretionary language. It says, quote, upon motion of any party in interest or upon the court's own motion, the court has the power to discharge the receiver and terminate the court's administration of the property over which the receivership was appointed. You contrast that with the other sections of 290, which are phrased in mandatory language. They use the word shall move the court to be discharged upon completion of duties, etc. It's pretty clear that this is a discretionary function. And considering the backdrop of receivership, we know it's a drastic remedy. It authorizes the court to seize a party's property. The state is basically taking control of private assets. So, you know, the cases are legion that receivership is not favored because it allows this divestiture of private control of private property. So why was it unreasonable for Judge Kessler to send the Westerdahls off to do exactly what they would have done in the context of a receivership, but for the fact that we have control over this private property, no longer needed? Their claim was not secured by anything. It was a verbal claim that Jay agreed to give me 25% of this asset. And it wasn't asserted until long after all the secured claims in the receivership had been dealt with. It was not an abuse of discretion, and it's a pretty simple resolution. Does the court have any further questions on this issue? We ask that it be affirmed. Thank you.
Yes, the question really before the court is, does process matter? And living in Seattle, I sometimes wonder if substance is more important. But in the courts, process is very important. And I'd refer...
What process are you referencing?
The receivership process. What we have here is,
well,
first...
Let me throw out something for you. If instead of appealing the dismissal, your clients had filed a separate lawsuit and filed for an expedited trial date based on their age and and firmness might not just be all over already?
I honestly don't know. I don't know. Perhaps.
So perhaps. if you're Judge Kessler, if that perhaps seems like the answer, why is it an abuse of discretion?
Well, Your Honor, first, contrary to what counsel says, the claim is not the $350,000 that
Oh, no, he was talking about something else for the $350,000.
The claim is substantially
it's
higher.
It's 25% of whatever this domain name's worth, and it could be a great big number from what people were willing to pay for it.
But it's not, that was my point, Your Honor. It's not 25% of this domain name. There is a bunch of work that the parents did for Jay that they were being paid for. There's $50,000 there. There's some other things that are set forth fully in the proof of claim.
Let's assume they're, it's a great big number.
Right.
And you're making it sound more complicated, which makes it sound like maybe this half-day hearing wouldn't work. Why could not someone reasonably conclude that it's a better to let these people go file a separate lawsuit and try and get expedited processing that way instead of having two things going?
Because right now we have a fully solvent receivership in which the senior Westerdahls have filed the claim, have gone through the process, the receiver has allowed the claim.
So is this a bond-free form of attachment? Is that makes this desirable?
In a way, yes, it is. There is no bond. The receiver has a bond. And as for the fees that the receiver is accruing, that's very simple. The receiver is a creature of the court.
Let's assume that judge had retained the receivership and processed all the way through, and your client's claims were found to have no merit. Is there any economic remedy available to the son, Jay, comparable to what would be available against a bond if there had been an attachment?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Would it be appropriate but for the judge in the receivership to take that into account in exercising his discretion?
I think that if we had a clean... May I finish my...
Sure.
If we had a clean debtor who had just showed up there and hadn't undertaken all of the actions that Jay had taken to defeat the receivership, perhaps that would be something that a court should take into account. But this is a case in which there were serious contempt motions against. Thank you.
Thank you.